All right, welcome to TYT Interviews. We got a really interesting interview tonight for you with Ryan Grimm. He is the DC bureau chief of The Intercept. He's also a TYT contributor. You can catch him on Rebel HQ, which you can find on YouTube, Facebook, and our app as well. Ryan, welcome to TYT Interviews. I want to talk to you about a really interesting and important story today. The reason we're doing it on TYT Interviews is because it's an important story that is not in the news right now, but that made news in a sense. And I wanted to break it down because I think it's instructive for the audience. You're the one who broke the story about Christine Blasey Ford in the first place in The Intercept. Now, at the time, you didn't have her name, but you were the first to talk about the fact that a Kavanaugh accuser existed. So that's fascinating. And so I want to talk about that with you. First of all, how did you know that an accuser existed in the first place?
So, and since I reported this, I've gone back and talked to some of the people, you know, that were closely involved with the Kavanaugh fight to kind of debrief them on when they first learned about this. And as far as I've been able to piece together, so on Thursday, on a Thursday in the fall, was the final day of Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation process. And nothing, you know, had emerged at that point about this alleged sexual assault. The next day after that, rumors started circulating among people in the Senate, which drifted out to people outside of the Senate. I didn't hear about it until Monday morning when somebody told me that there was this rumor going around. And so I just started asking everybody that I knew, you know, who had anything to do with the Kavanaugh confirmation battle, if they had heard this. And the you know, the more I asked, the closer I would get to somebody who had a closer you know, connection to it. Eventually, somebody said, you know, the letter originally came into Anna Eshoo, you know, that she was a constituent of Eshoo's, and then later Feinstein got involved. And so I reached out to Eshoo's office, and you know, they effectively confirmed it. And I have a quote from their spokesperson, you know, in the story saying this is a constituent matter. We don't discuss constituent matters. Then I also heard, as I was asking around, that there were people on the committee, the senators on the committee, who knew about this letter and wanted access to it, but that Feinstein was withholding that access. All of a sudden, that becomes an awfully relevant story, because you now have senators in the same party disagreeing over what to do with this letter that is in Feinstein's possession. The senators who wanted access to it didn't trust Feinstein's judgment to just unilaterally withhold it. They didn't necessarily want the letter published in full, but they wanted an opportunity to read it, to review it privately, and make their own judgment then on whether they should talk to the accuser, whether they should talk to the FBI, or what they should do, rather than just leaving it to Feinstein. And so once I was able to confirm with a number of sources that there were senators who were frustrated by Feinstein's handling of this, who wanted this letter, then that alone, that in itself is a story, because you have a disagreement between members of the same party over an extremely consequential question, the handling of the confirmation of the Kavanaugh hearing. And then along the way, there's some, I picked up a couple other things, one of them being that she was being represented by Deborah Katz. I still didn't know her name at this point. And so I called the law firm of Deborah Katz, and I did kind of what is a fairly basic journalism move, which is to say you act as if the other party knows exactly what you're talking about. And if they do, then they have in a way confirmed to you that what you know is true. And so I said, and it is great to do this with receptionists, people who answer the phone, who are not you know, who are not trying to carry out political marching orders. They're just doing their jobs. So I called up and said, you know, I'm writing a story about the letter that was sent to Anna Eshoo and Dianne Feinstein containing the sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. You know, who's the lawyer who's handling that case? And the receptionist said, oh, I'll tell you who's handling that. Let me connect you with them now. And so immediately, okay, this tip was accurate. This letter exists. Deborah Katz is indeed her attorney, and the outlines that were described to me are correct, that it involved Eshoo and Feinstein. So then when she connected me with an attorney, you know, we spoke, and there's a decline to comment is in the article. But that gets you to a place where you know what the you know a lot of what's going on. But interestingly, nobody at that point was saying don't publish this letter, don't publish the existence of this letter, don't say anything about it. There was no talk of that until later.
So Ryan, I have a lot of questions, and that's an amazing story, and the way you got the law firm to confirm it was awesome. and so I know you can't reveal your sources, but I'm curious about different things that we can conclude from your story. So it seems very fair to conclude that Feinstein genuinely didn't want the letter to get out.
That is my belief. And you know, they never, you know, I reached out to them on that Monday. I published a story on Wednesday evening, and I, you know, didn't hear back from them for 3 days. But it's my belief that they did not want this published, that they did not want this fight. Ronan Farrow and Jane Merritt did some interesting follow-up reporting within a few days of my story, where they have sources in Feinstein's orbit talking about Feinstein's thinking. And what you learn from that is that Blasey Ford reached out in July to Eshoo, talked to Feinstein's office later in July. And when she sent the letter to Eshoo and to Feinstein, it said, please keep this in confidence until we have had a chance to speak. You know, it was not the kind of, you know, don't ever share this with anyone kind of line. It was just like, mm-hmm. don't say anything about this until we've had a chance to talk. And she told all of her friends, I have decided to take the plunge. You know, that, and then Sacramento Bee has reported that she had wrestled with it emotionally, psychically, and decided that this was the right thing to do and that she was going to go for it and do it. But then, according to Farrow and Mayer, she had several conversations with Feinstein's office, and that Feinstein's position was this was too long ago for it to matter. And you heard that objection a ton from Republicans. And you also learned that Feinstein's strategic preference was to keep the confirmation battle on legal grounds rather than to get into personal behavior. So after hearing that from Feinstein's camp, and then after watching over the summer as it appeared like Kavanaugh was headed towards confirmation, at that point, she at some point said that she didn't want to come forward. And interestingly, she sent a letter to Feinstein saying, thank you for honoring my request to stay private, which to me is an odd letter to send, or not an odd letter to send, but it reads like a letter that Feinstein may have requested to memorialize an agreement that actually she wasn't going to come forward. You know, Schumer and Feinstein have made no secret of the fact that they didn't think that this was a winnable fight, and that they were worried that it would, you know, cost them their chance to win back the Senate. And, you know, in their political defense, indeed, the fight over Kavanaugh did, you know, rally the Trump base. Now, whether Trump would have been able to rally them with more caravans or a bombing somewhere, or, you know, who knows what trick he had, you know, to kind of for his turnkey racist operation. But that was a concern. So I think you're right that she genuinely did not want this out. And all of these attacks on her from the right, ironically, are completely off base.
So when Dr. Blasey Ford originally said, I'm ready to take the plunge, that was well before your article. That was in, she had sent the letter, she talked to the Feinstein and Eshoo office, she decides she's gonna take the plunge. But then at that point, if I'm understanding this story right and the chronology right, Feinstein and Schumer decide we don't want this fight. So it appears that they originally held it under ethical grounds because she said, wait until we talk. Then they held it on political grounds, even though Blasey Ford was ready to go.
I don't have any reporting that confirms Schumer was involved with this conversation. You would assume that the minority leader would be involved with some this kind of decision at this high level, but I don't have any reporting that confirms that. But certainly we know that Feinstein did through her staff convey to her that this wasn't going to be a winning strategy to come forward. And Blasey Ford still at that point could have forced it into the public, but I think she decided based on all of the various inputs that okay, this judiciary, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee doesn't think that it's going to be effective, doesn't think people are going to believe it because it happened so long ago, or it was too long ago, so it won't matter. And it looks like he's cruising, so why don't I not do this? Oh, and also in the timeline, she reached out to the Washington Post. That gets overlooked sometimes. So she was in communication with a reporter at the Washington Post who was the first to actually tell her full story. And this was back in July. She reached out to their tip line.
So why didn't they print it back then?
So that is a story that that reporter will maybe tell in her memoir one day. But between the time of their first contact and the final story being published was when those conversations with Feinstein's office were ongoing. And so it appears like she told the reporter, I've decided I don't want to go public.
Yeah, look, that part of the story is disconcerting. The Washington Post part as well, but mainly, and we'll leave Schumer out of it because it's not confirmed, Feinstein deciding, I don't want to fight. I think it'll be politically damaging, annoying, whatever. I mean, that is Democratic 101. And so if your story had not come out, it's possible the story never would have come out, even though Dr. Blasey Ford had decided in the middle that she did want it to come out. But she trusted Feinstein, and Feinstein apparently gave her advice based on some political calculations, not necessarily on what was the right thing to do. But that's me interpreting it now.
Let's play Feinstein advocate. Mm-hmm. What did happen? He did get confirmed anyway. She was attacked viciously.
Yeah.
It did hurt some. It did hurt some red state senators and some rural Democrats. Now, is the conclusion to draw from that you don't ever fight, is there glory in the fight? Is there a reason? Is that what we're here to do?
So to me, that's a no-brainer. First of all, on the morality of the issue. Once Dr. Blasey Ford says, I'm ready to take the plunge and do it, you got to do it. You got to tell her story because it's not fair to her and it's not fair to women not to tell that story, right?
Right, and exactly. And so to play non-advocate for Feinstein, she set Blasey Ford up to appear like she was part of some type of political setup by these allegations coming out at the last minute. So if you're just a regular observer from the sidelines, it does look like they've tried everything else and now they're going to try this allegation. But in fact, that was the complete opposite of what had happened. Blasey Ford reached out to the Washington Post and to Anna Eshoo's office while Kavanaugh was still on the short list. He hadn't even been nominated yet. She was trying to save the White House from themselves. She wasn't trying to be part of some last minute blowing up of the process. And so Democrats, by being meek about it, put her in this rough situation. And who knows if she had come out immediately, this situation may have been completely different.
No, Ryan, I knew a lot of those details, but not all of them, I have to confess. And having heard the story in its entirety now, I think that if they had come out when Blasey Ford wanted to come out, it might have been a totally different story. There might have been a lot more time to investigate. They might have actually talked to, some of the more of the witnesses. It would have given more time for more women to come forward. And some of them might have been confirmed, some of them might have been debunked, but it would have been a fuller hearing. It would have been, we would have had a better chance to determine if it had happened. And as usual, it's Democrats not fighting. And they lost those seats not because of Kavanaugh. They lost those seats because of that same exact attitude. They don't like to fight. So Joe Donnelly said the Republicans are right, and the voters agreed.
Right. And so, you're exactly right.
So, Ryan, I want to go to the next part of the story because it's also really interesting. Now, your sources, was it that it was rumors to begin with that you heard kind of almost randomly, like buzz around town, or without naming who it is, obviously, did someone from another senator's office come to you like, hey, you might want to look into this?
It wasn't initially another senator's office, but it was somebody who reached out to me, not as a like, we're just, shooting the breeze over coffee. They reached out because they know that I'm the kind of reporter, that is willing to do a story that is going to ruffle the feathers of Democratic leadership, and that might get blowback from all manner of, from all different directions. But that, I'm the kind of reporter that if it's a true story and if it's important, then you report it, regardless of what the political consequences are, or the consequences to your access, or any other considerations along those lines. You follow the story where it goes and you run it. And so I do end up getting a decent number of tips, for that reason. The Rob Porter case was actually very similar from a completely different source. But it was somebody who came to me and was like, look, Rob Porter is, everybody's source in the White House. He was the source basically for most of Bob Woodward's book. If you remember the first year of the Trump administration, all of these fly on the wall stories coming out, it was Rob Porter. And the source is like, look, I don't have much more on this, but he beat his wife, and nobody will report it. And I've become one of the reporters in Washington that people will bring that kind of a story to, I'll report it.
So Ryan, that's interesting on a couple of counts. I want to come back to the Blasey Ford story in a second, but so if I'm hearing you right, because this might be common knowledge in Washington and reporting circles, but it isn't common knowledge to the audience. So a lot of the reporters will not report things if it's going to cause them to lose access to Democratic leadership.
Right, and they don't outright refuse. They don't say, they won't say to somebody, I'm not going to report that because it's going to hurt my access. The way it functions in practice is they will get a tip. They will say, oh man, that's a really great tip. Thank you for this. I'm on this. And then a week later, source might say, hey, how's that coming? And it's like, been really busy with Trump's tweet and this and that and the other thing, getting on it really soon. And for some, I think it's not even conscious. They just kind of know that this is a really troubling story for me. I'm going to have a hard time getting past some editors, perhaps. B, it's really going to screw me, with sources in the White House. And so you just kind of slow walk it. And in the back of your mind, you hope that maybe somebody else breaks it, and then you can do a follow-up piece with a lot of background details that you might have collected along the way. That's still a nice story. You've got a chunk of it, but you're not the one, that's feeling the heat for breaking it. And that ends up being the way that it works a lot. And so people who deal with reporters eventually, come to recognize those patterns of, oh, I gave that tip and, a month later, nothing had happened with it. Yeah. And it's never said and sometimes, it's their credit to say, no, I'm not doing that piece.
And on the Rob Porter story, since he's the source for a lot of the reporters in the White House, they don't want to report that he beat his wife.
And I think that cuts both ways. And one, it's on the one hand, it's biting the hand that feeds you. It's killing the golden goose. On the other hand, once you've gotten to know somebody personally, you've had some beers, you talk about college football. It becomes more difficult for you to then write a story that destroys his career, or gets him fired, or levels an allegation of that level that he was, abusive to his spouse, even if there's firm evidence that it's true. And so the sympathies wind up lying with the person that you know, rather than with the first wife or the second wife, who, if you happen to have been close with them, your decision would probably be different.
Yeah, all of this is fascinating. Let's go back to the Kavanaugh story. And I'm gonna ask the question, you tell me what you're at liberty to disclose or not. I wanted to go back to the original person who gave you the tip. Was it a staffer from a senator's office?
No, it wasn't. It was just somebody who was just, roughly involved in politics and knew about it and knew they could and thought that I might be the kind of person that might be interested in hearing it and might be able to do something with it.
And it's obviously a person who had access to it, because you got the story right. You said it was an incident back in high school.
One thing I said in the piece was that I talked to four or five different sources who knew about it, and I heard different versions of it, because they hadn't actually seen, like my sources had not seen the letter. The letter was extremely closely guarded. And so all they had heard was what they'd heard about the letter. And so some people said it involves an attempted rape in a room in a party. Other people said, it might just be that they locked somebody in a closet at a party. And so the weight of the evidence was much closer to the attempted rape, but there were other sources that were saying that they'd heard something slightly different, because since none of them had read it, you get the game of telephone going on.
And do you know what the motivation of your source was? Did they think that Feinstein was making a mistake by not releasing this letter?
They did, and they also had heard rumors that there were other women who had stories to tell, but didn't want to be the first one to come forward. And perhaps they were thinking of his Yale classmate who eventually did come forward, or perhaps they were thinking of some of the clerks that he had previously worked for who came out through an intermediary to say that Kavanaugh knew of sexual harassment by his former mentor. So, some of the sources I talked to believe that, if this story came out, that it could snowball and that other people would come forward, which did end up happening.
So let's talk about that real quick. So you print the story, and it does not have her name, but it has details that turn out to be true. And you got the confirmation through the law firm, and you did all the things that you described in the beginning. And what happened next after the story went to print?
So we put it up. I was going through the final edits while I was doing a TYT Live hit on Rebel HQ with Eric Beiler. I had my laptop there while we were talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation. And right after that ended, we hit publish on it, and that was close to 5:30. On Wednesday, and the timing was such that the Senate was returning from its Labor Day break for a vote at 5:30 that evening. So the story gets published. It immediately goes out. The Capitol Hill Press Corps is constantly on their phones, waiting for senators to come back from their break and come to a vote inside the Senate chamber. And as they go to the vote, they walk past all the reporters, and it's a custom that most of them stop and talk to the reporters on their way in and on their way out. That's how a lot of reporters get their access. So I knew the vote was at 5:30. We published it shortly before that. So all of these reporters see, Feinstein has this letter. Judiciary Committee Democrats want this letter, but she's not giving it to them. And then they see Feinstein, and then they see Judiciary Committee Democrats. And so Feinstein doesn't comment, she usually does comment, does talk with reporters, but she doesn't in that situation. Gets in a car, heads away from the Capitol. But that evening, then the members of the committee say, look, we've read this story in The Intercept. We need to meet tonight, and we need to talk about, this situation. And so they have a meeting that night, and they press upon her, if there are serious allegations of criminal conduct, this should be turned over to the FBI. And so at that point, Feinstein that night turns the letter over to the FBI. And what that does is it puts it in his FBI background file, which is then accessible to everybody in the White House and everybody in the Judiciary Committee. And one interesting thing if people go back and read the history of this, did she contact Blasey Ford before making that decision? From all the reporting I've seen and from what I've been able to gather, she did not talk to her between having that meeting and turning the letter over to the FBI, which is discordant with the idea of I'm not going to share the letter with anyone. It's not asterisk. I'm not going to share the letter with anyone unless I'm put under political pressure by other Democrats in the committee.
Yeah. So another mystery to me that is further enhanced by the story you just told is how many people in the committee knew, the other Democratic senators, and how many didn't? Because there's enough people that know that rumors are buzzing. No other reporter picks it up other than you, but at the time. But it appears, based on what you just said, that some of them were genuinely surprised she had the letter. And they're like, what are you doing? You got to give that to the FBI. So do we have any sense of how many knew and how many didn't?
My sense is a handful knew, but not all of them. And some of them, I believe, learned from other reporters who were making inquiries. But I don't believe that that all of them knew about it. And so some of them did learn about it from my story, and then that that triggered them to press harder. Now, some of them already did know about it, and it's possible that if I hadn't written the story, they still would have personally gone to Feinstein and said, we want to see this letter, and forced the issue to the surface without my piece ever happening. That's quite possible. But we don't know.
But it wasn't a senator staffer who came to you, so there's no one particular senator who knew and absolutely needed it to get out. And we don't know that. They hadn't pressured her before your story, so that's pretty compelling evidence that. And it was almost over at that point that they were.
It was close. Yeah. Well, the vote was that week, right?
Yeah. And so very possible they would not have gone to her, and certainly would not have gone to her in unison. So that's interesting. That's the other part that I was going to talk about, which is what was the chances that it never comes out, right? Because I assume other reporters knew about it because there's rumors in Washington. And as soon as you printed it, they all had it. I don't know if they immediately read all of your stories, but that was something.
They read Twitter immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And they all stand near each other. So once one person sees something, they tell the other reporters around them too.
Right. So it looks like if you hadn't printed it, if you hadn't gone and bothered to call the law firm and confirm it and do all that stuff and hadn't printed it, there is some percentage chance that that story never would have gotten out. Kavanaugh would have been confirmed. We never would have known what he might have done, although I think having after exhaustively watched those hearings and the aftermath, I'm pretty sure he did do.
Yeah, he did it. He may think he didn't. I think that's plausible.
Yeah.
But right.
Yeah.
Right. And then the question is, would it have come out after he was confirmed? Because at this point, like I said, lots of people in Washington knew the contours of it. And so what are the chances that that never came out? And then you'd be living in a world where Democrats knew about this this extraordinary allegation from this extraordinarily credible woman, and did absolutely nothing about it, and ushered him through to the Supreme Court unchallenged. So at least in the world we do live in, he was forced to grapple with what he had done in the past, and that the public knows about it, and that every decision that he renders from now on will be in that context.
So, Ryan, another point I had not considered at all. That's true. If it had come out afterwards, my God, the rage that Democratic voters would have had about the senators who knew and sat on their hands, Feinstein had planned to do if you hadn't printed it.
And in hindsight, people would have been certain that if the allegation would have come out, they would have been able to stop him. Now we know that actually that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Republicans are willing to ram him onto the Supreme Court regardless. So that was something else that the public learned. But right, the outrage at them sitting on it would be coupled with a certainty that if they had done something about it, they would have been able to keep him off the Supreme Court.
And it would have seemed like the Democrats chose to let him go on the court knowing they could have stopped him. Wow.
Right.
They are so incompetent at politics, let alone the morality of the situation. Did you get a sense of how many other reporters knew but couldn't get confirmation or didn't want to get confirmation? Like, since it was going around town, and did you talk to other reporters about it afterwards?
Shortly after the next day or so, I heard from one news outlet that said, you know, we had roughly what you had, but didn't go with it. And then I heard from other sources in the Senate that they would hear from other reporters, oh, I had that, but I didn't go with it. And a lot of them were saying that they regretted not thinking of the idea of framing it as a fight between the Democrats on the committee and the ranking member Feinstein, and instead were trying to confirm the details of the allegation rather than that there was a fight over what to do about the allegation. So I don't know how many, but it seems like from everything I've picked up that probably half a dozen outlets or more.
So half a dozen or so. Okay. So Ryan, it's not to congratulate you, although it's an amazing story and it made a giant difference and potentially could have made all the difference in the world. But it's to understand the process. So was it their editors who said, you know, hey, you don't have enough? Did you get a sense from them as to why the half a dozen or so at the end of the day did not print it?
Yes, in some cases, editors and in some cases, the reporters just didn't think they had enough to go on, because they were trying to get the actual letter itself, and sometimes you can be myopic in your reporting that if you set out a goal, okay, I know that there's this letter, I need to obtain this letter. so that I can, you know, so that I can publish it. And then if you can't get the letter, you give up and you move on to something else, instead of continuing to ask other questions and finding, you know, what the real story might be behind the letter, which is in this case was the strategic struggle between the Democrats on the committee. And so that I think was a big part of it. Probably also the fait accompli with which the confirmation was being treated at that time. You know, you were considered a maniac if you thought that there was even a slight chance that he might be stopped. And so when reporters feel like they know what the outcome of a situation is, they kind of move on before it's quite over.
Is it a little bit, is it fair to say, you know, I don't want to pick on other folks too much, but is it fair to say that if it was earlier in the process and they thought it had a chance of stopping the confirmation, that there would have been a little bit more glory in it and hence the need to push a little harder?
Yeah, and that's in some ways, like, you could reframe that in a way that makes perfect sense to how people allocate their time. You know, people want the highest impact stories. And right. So if they feel like it's going to have more impact earlier on, then they might invest more time on it. But towards, you know, exactly. Like if Gillum is behind by 10 points and somebody gives you a story that there are, you know, there's a box of 200 provisional ballots that were mistreated, you might say that's too bad, but he's down by 10,000 votes. But if he's down by 100, all of a sudden those 200 votes become the thing you care about more than anything. So in some senses it is rational, to take into account the outcome of it, but it also requires you to have a broader imagination about what is possible.
Right. That makes sense as well. And so I imagine that some folks gave you credit, if you will, for breaking the story. And there was probably a lot of folks who thought, well, that was a great job getting the confirmation and it turning out to be correct, et cetera. But did you get any blowback? Did you get any criticism for it?
Yeah, and it was one of those stories where journalists are extremely competitive and we love it when we get big scoops. And this ended up being a huge one in the way that it shaped the conversation, but it never kind of felt that way to me. It was never something I was out kind of celebrating, because it was such a personal, a delicate, difficult situation for Christine Blasey Ford, who I didn't know who she was, never had a chance to speak to her, and the people who were advocating for her, and we can get into this maybe further down the road, never, if it was the case that she absolutely didn't want the story out, that message was never delivered before the ball got rolling, but because of the heightened sensitivity of it, I very much did not want to be part of the story, and I didn't want my reporting to be part of the story. I wanted her to be able to, take center stage when she decided to come forward. So I didn't want to talk about her lawyers or anything else. And in the very beginning, there were some people who said, what are you doing, outing a sexual assault survivor against her will? And I didn't even really push back in the moment. I just kind of let them, let the critics say that. My argument would have been, if I was going to push back, well, that it wasn't against her will. Nobody told me who she was, nor did they tell me she didn't want to come forward. And interestingly, it was other reporters, Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer, New York Times, who actually did report, apparently against her will, significant details of what happened. My story only said it involved, I forget the exact wording, but, you know, an incident between, you know, an allegation of an incident between, between her and between a woman and Kavanaugh while she was in high school. So yeah, it wasn't a situation where, I was out throwing myself a parade.
No, I totally get that. I'm also wondering though, if there was, whether there was any blowback from senators, leadership, Democrats. I don't know if anyone at The Intercept cares about that, but but was there any?
You know, not a ton, because the relationship that The Intercept has with the Democratic leadership and with the kind of, you know, some of the more establishment figures of the Democratic Party, to use an overused phrase, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. We talk. It's in my interest to talk to them, to allow them to give me their side. It's in their interest to give me their side. But nobody's under any illusions that we're, we're the best of friends here. And so it wasn't, you know, in other words, there wasn't a whole lot of relationship to kind of burn. Although the individual people, Congress is an interesting place, since the Senate and House are interesting places. All of the individual staffers there, I get along great with, because they're doing their job and they're doing the best job that they can. But it's on the up and up. You know, The Intercept says on its front page, we do adversarial journalism. Yeah, I'm a contributor to the Young Turks. Young Turks makes no secret about what its approach to journalism is. And so as long as that's on the table, it's easy to have a very collegial, friendly relationship, even if the product itself might cause a lot of heartburn in the end.
Yeah, look, you did the story for The Intercept. You happen to talk about it on a Young Turks stream. But I would have been highly amused if someone came to me and said, you know, Ryan Grimm works for the Young Turks, and, you know, and he broke this story, and we're really mad about it in the Senate.
Right. Right.
I would have been like, yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, right. Not about
the Blasey Ford situation, right? Obviously, as you pointed out earlier, but that you made Democratic senators angry. That's your job.
That is the job. And everybody, and that's the irony of access journalism. Everybody knows that we're not going anywhere. They're probably not going anywhere. Might as well, get along. We're going to be doing this every day. You might get better stories from Rob Porter if you don't, put that story out. But there are going to be dozens of more people in that position, and in positions like it. If you want to just do it on a cost benefit analysis, you actually might get better stories and do better journalism without worrying about that.
Yeah, trust me, there'll be more leakers in the Trump White House. Right. So, super last thing here in the minute that we have left, Ryan. When you hit send, did you have any idea how big the story was going to be?
No. I knew it was a wild card. It was, if the 10 or 11 version of what I'd been hearing was in the letter was accurate, then yes, then I thought that this would be explosive. If it was, as some people had said, that he attempted to rape someone with somebody else present in the room, then I did. But I wasn't 100% sure that that's what the allegation was. If the allegation were just he locked a 15-year-old in a closet and was really rude to them, then I assumed that it would just kind of vanish. And so when the New York Times, confirmed that the letter existed, but then also reported the details that it involved an alleged rape, that's when I knew, okay, that because I had heard many more details of the attempted rape, then knowing that those were right, I was like, okay, now this is going to be a huge story.
Yep. All right, Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept and Young Turks contributor. Thank you for joining us. Amazing story. Appreciate you telling it.